noise from the bus, and it lurched to Amy's right. The current was grabbing at it, trying to yank it downstream, to swallow it up, to drown everyone on board. Amy ran toward the rear of the bus, yelling, "Cover me!" in Ted's direction. No idea if he could hear her. All she could hear were screams and the thundering stampede of angry water. She would have to jump to climb up on the rear bumper. The air exploded around her, and she tumbled down to the pavement. She heard shouts, Ted yelling strategy commands that meant nothing to her. He was crouched on the bank of the river, water breaking and spraying around his legs, shooting in her direction. Not at her, but at the black cloaks that were now right on top of her. The cloaks fired back at Ted, leaving orange afterimages in Amy's vision like fiery claw marks. She scrambled to her feet and ran toward the bus once more. It lurched and scraped again, getting pulled along the bank. She tried to jump up onto the bumper, but at the last moment, a strong, bony hand seized her by the arm, yanked her back, and tossed her. She went face first into the flooded area along the riverbank, nostrils burning as she inhaled water. She lost her glasses. She sputtered and tried to get to her feet. She heard screams and turned. A black cloak climbed up on the bus, ripping open the rear door. John. The cloak was about to start pumping brimstone down onto the larva, and John knew he only had a window of about 2 seconds to do something about it. He hadn't brought a weapon. Fortunately, the universe quickly granted him one. Ted, firing from the riverbank, nailed one of the cloaks between John and the bus, the thing's strange shotgun flipping into the air and right into John's hands. John aimed and pulled the trigger. Yellow threads of fire laced through the air. He hit the cloak right in the back. It stumbled forward, almost falling down into the bus, then turned to face him. It was Babyface. John reminded himself that under the cloak, the thing was wearing body armor. John aimed and pulled the trigger a second time, aiming right for that stupid, puffy-cheeked face. There was only a dry click. John tossed the gun aside, ran, and leaped up onto the back of the bus. He tried to wrestle the cloak's gun out of its hands, face to face with its ghoulish infant features and those tiny little rubber teeth. They tussled, and John felt something shoving his feet aside. Giant maggots were boiling out of the rear door of the bus, squirming out in every direction. The cloak took advantage of the distraction and smacked John in the jaw with the butt of his gun. John stumbled back, grabbed the cloak, and both went tumbling into the water. Me. The larva was pulsing. The two empty wounds from which I'd extracted the first pellets were now black holes, staring at me like shark eyes, a calculating, gleeful intelligence behind them. I could sense it talking to me, taunting me, making me promises about what awaited once it was free from its shell. Every time the forceps slipped off a projectile, it laughed. So ready to be free, gazing upon our world and seeing a new toy to play with, a helpless thing to torture. I blinked and tried to concentrate. The two remaining pellets were deep, too deep for the forceps, and I couldn't get a firm grip on either one because the maggot kept thrashing around. Loretta had been joined by Marconi, both of them failing to keep my patient still. I fumbled with the projectile, the larva howling under me. I couldn't get it. I glanced at Loretta, who was watching me, eyes wide, the life of her baby slipping out of my trembling, incompetent hands. She saw the apology in my eyes, and I watched her die a little inside. Desperate, I screamed, "Joy, get back here!" She appeared. "Can you, see what's going on here? Really? See? Not just Maggie, but the..." She nodded quickly. "Help me hold her down. Why can't we roll her over? What good would..." Instead of explaining, Joy just pushed everyone back and rolled the swollen larva off the sofa and onto the floor, wound side down. She slapped the larva twice. Then she rolled it back, and two smoking little balls were lying there on the floor, cooking the carpet. They had just fallen right out. Amy. Amy saw John and the cloak tumble into the water. Kids were trying to crawl out of the rear door of the bus, climbing over each other, crying out for their parents. The shooting had stopped from Ted's end, and Amy could sense from his manner that he had run out of bullets. That infuriated Amy. How could he run out of bullets? Always having lots of bullets was his whole thing. That was like an internet provider running out of snide indifference. Ted pulled out a knife and splashed out of the water, advancing on the one remaining cloak who was still on dry land and upright. Amy moved toward the bus once more. It shifted again under the force of the current, tilting now, almost tossing the escaping children overboard. Could they drown? She yelled for them to be calm, said she was coming. Then there was a gunshot from behind her, and Amy swore she felt the bullet whistle by her ear this time. She thought she might have peed her pants a little. She turned, and there was the female agent with the bloody shirt. Amy could no longer remember what name they were calling her. Amy said, "You can't hurt me. Remember, it will blow back on you." The woman said, "Just step aside. It's been a long week." Slung over her shoulder was the shotgun they'd given to David back at the wellness center, only Amy assumed it was now functional. Amy said, "This may seem like a weird time to ask, but what's your name again?" "Bella." "Listen, Bella, shooting them causes them to hatch. That's what they want." The agent sighed.
"And who told you that?"
"I don't..."
"We figured it out. You have to trust me."
"So these creatures, whose entire process is based around deception, convinced you that they can't be harmed, and you don't see why I'm skeptical of this claim? What exactly is your plan? Long term, I mean?"
"I don't know. I don't know, okay?"
The look of disdain on Agent Bella's face burned right through the downpour. The rain had spread her blood stain down her shirt, fading to pink around the edges. Children were yelling. Nearby, Amy could hear what sounded like Ted stabbing a cloaked figure to death. The agent brought the shotgun around and marched forward. Me. We lifted the larva back onto the sofa. The four wounds were no longer smoking, but they also weren't going away either. I held a hand over the holes and felt what I thought an astronaut would feel if he found a crack in the ship's hull while floating in the most desolate, frozen void at the edge of the cosmos. Not just coldness, but darkness and a sense of the vast, inhuman eternity that lay beyond. Was it too late? The larva was swollen, now in the shape of a football, tugging and straining on the gashes in the translucent leathery hide. I said, "So I'm not sure how to treat the wounds on this," I almost said thing, but Maggie's mother was right there and already seemed pretty confused. "Situation." Marconi said, "Is there bleeding?" "Not blood, no." Loretta said, "There's blood everywhere." Joyce said, "Then treat the wounds." She looked at Marconi. "Treat the little girl, same as you would anybody." He looked at me. I shrugged. The larva was no longer thrashing around and howling with its piercing wounded bird noises. It just lay there and made a low, squishy moaning sound. In the sand bowl, all four pellets continued to crackle and burn, the stench of brimstone filling the RV. Marconi dug out packages of gauze from his first aid kit and went to work. Outside, I heard gunshots and Amy yelling at someone. I left the larva and its three caretakers behind and ran for the door. When I grasped the handle to open it, I found my hand was sticky. I was surprised to find it was covered in blood. Maggie's, I guess? Whatever. Just as I was about to step out, I noticed that leaning next to the door was Marconi's antique spear, wicked chiseled notches in its gleaming obsidian head. I grabbed it and shoved through the door into the maelstrom. John. If John and his attacker had fallen on the downstream side of the sinking school bus, he'd no doubt have been whisked down the river on his way to the Gulf of Mexico. Instead, they fell upstream, meaning the current was now crushing their bodies against the side of the bus. There was no ground under John's feet, The only thing keeping his head above the surface was the current pinning him to the white metal wall and the grip of his left hand, which was clutching a grating next to the bus's wheel well. John had lost track of the cloak that had tumbled into the river with him, and he had hoped maybe it had gotten swept away. But then a hand erupted out of the water and clutched John around the throat. The fingers felt thin and sinewy, like the talons on a bird. Up from the water came the baby face mask, only blackness behind the blank eye holes. In a voice that sounded like a colon tumor that had grown a mouth, the cloak said,
"Even now, you do not believe you can die. Do you know what awaits you once you have been plunged into the black swarm? A most profound penetration that will split you wide, a violation without end. Your shock, their narcotic. Your despair, their aphrodisiac. How can you not already hear their lustful howls? You who bear the mark of men."
The bony hand forced John's head underwater. He struggled to grasp the side of the bus to pull himself up, but his fingers peeled loose and he was drowning. The crush of the water, an incomprehensible force, pushing the last air out of his lungs. John clawed helplessly at the talons around his neck, feeling his own numb fingers growing weaker. Then there was a shape in the water above him, visible only as a shadow in the rippling reflection of the headlights from the shore. Something floating toward him, carried by the current. Whatever it was, the cloak was distracted by it, turning away from his prey. John seized the opportunity and wrenched free of the claw, pulling himself up out of the water, sputtering and spitting. John wiped water out of his eyes and saw what was bobbing his way. A pink silicone ass. Ted's pickup was now fully submerged upstream, and the truck's rubber ass cargo had spilled into the rushing water. The cloak stared in wonderment as one ass after another flowed its way, 2 dozen of them, bobbing along majestically. The cloak screamed in despair.
"The prophecy! It is true!"
It turned its vacant eyes upward, rainwater filling the holes of the mask and dribbling out like tears.
"You have summoned him."
A pale blur whipped down from the sky. It snatched the cloak, whisking it from the water. It carried the struggling figure up, then flung it off into the distance, the cloaked thing landing soundlessly somewhere downstream. John climbed up the side of the bus, shook wet hair from his face, and yelled,
"Hey, Pusnado! It looks like your ship just hit an assberg, because your man just got assassinated. Hey, do you mind if I ass you something?"
Amy. No one could hear what John was yelling from the water. "You know what really gets me?" said the agent behind the gun. "The sheer arrogance of it all. You've convinced yourself you're taking some kind of moral stand, but you don't care that you're putting the whole world at risk for it. You're so sure you're right. I bet you win every argument with your boys. The little nerd girl, bitch, your ego could blot out the sun." Ted was shouting now, joining the chorus of shouts from almost everyone in the vicinity. He was standing over the defeated black cloak, looking up at something, mouth agape. He screamed, "Get down!" Amy didn't even have time to obey. She and the agent both looked up in time to see a pale blur whoosh down from the sky. The Bat Mantis landed heavily on one of the non-trucks. Gunshots rang out. The female agent was unloading on the beast with her brimstone shotgun. The monster leaped off the truck and pinned her to the street, water breaking and splattering around her shoulders. The agent didn't drop the gun. She worked the barrel around and pressed it right to the Bat Mantis's face. The creature made a quick swipe with one of its serrated claws, and something went rolling away, splashing through the standing water at the side of the road. It was the agent's severed head. "Amy!" It was David, running toward them, hands and shirt covered in blood, carrying some kind of pole. He frantically looked back and forth from Amy to the winged beast.
Amy screamed. I think it's helping us. That's why it kept turning up. It's trying to help. But the bat mantis chose that moment to lunge at her, swiping a claw and missing only because it clumsily stumbled over its own misshapen feet. David yelled, No! It's an asshole! Get away! The beast lurched in her direction. Amy dove and rolled away. She sprinted toward David. He brandished the object she now realized was a spear from Marconi's collection, putting himself between Amy and the monster. The beast spun around to face them. Instead of teeth, it had a ragged kind of beak, powerful jaws. It was no herbivore. David yelled, No, we did not survive all this shit just to get eaten by your stupid ass. Just go away. Amy said to it, We're the good guys. It's okay. The thing snatched at David. He thrust the spear at it, backing it off. No, he screamed at it. No! Don't you see, you dumb son of a bitch? We don't want to kill you! Can you even hear me, you fucking animal? I will put this through your goddamn neck! The thing just looked confused. Not evil, Amy thought, just scared and hungry and lashing out blindly at a world it didn't understand. The bat mantis lunged again, not at David, but past him. It was going for Amy. David growled, No! He jabbed at it with the spear as it passed. He got it, right in the side. It recoiled. Dark blood oozed. The thing screeched. And then the monster smiled. Amy was sure of it, as if it finally had a fight, like this was what it had come for. The bat mantis whipped a claw through the air with a pale blur, and David's spear went flying. David, in a blind rage, did not back down. Come on! Come over here and die, you fucking animal! I fought shit that would keep you for a pet! He turned quickly toward Amy. Run! I'll keep it busy. She didn't. The bat mantis swung a claw, bashing David to the ground. Effortless. It jumped on him, pinning him just as it had done to the agent moments ago. Amy screamed. David yelled again for her to go. She stayed. He clawed at the thing's face, yelling, Look at you! You are a mistake! A malfunction! You eat me, I will fuck you from the inside! The thing raised a claw, meaning to lop off David's head. Amy suddenly remembered the taser. She yanked it out of her back pocket, ran up, and pressed it against the monster's neck, the blue flashes of electricity popping against its skin. It didn't paralyze it, but it did cause it to recoil again, to stagger backward. Amy stabbed a finger at it. Last chance! You have to go! You understand? We have been more than patient. The monster snarled, then yelped and stumbled forward. Something had slammed into it from behind. John. There were now six of the huge, squealing maggots clinging to the top of the bus, and more were crawling out, crowding each other. John was thus having trouble finding purchase on the upturned rear, and thought it would look bad to Amy if he just started shoving children off into the water to make room. John heard someone from shore tell everyone to get down, then the bat mantis swooped overhead, landing on a vehicle nearby. There were gunshots, and then the shots abruptly ended. Then it looked like the beast was confronting someone, its jumbled limbs and wings thrashing around in the silhouette of the RV's headlights. John heard enraged and panicked cries through the rain. Dave and Amy were confronting the monster, and from the sound of it, losing. Frantic, John awkwardly climbed around to the rear bumper of the bus and tried to get his feet over the pavement, only a small corner of the bus still overhung solid land. He managed to drop onto the street. Two of the maggots were already there, having crawled off the bus. John turned. A man was running past him. It was Ted, running with purpose and rage, running to confront the beast he believed had taken his child. He was carrying the backpack containing the brimstone bomb. Ted jumped onto the back of the bat mantis, getting it in a chokehold, a muscled arm wrapped around what passed for the thing's neck. The creature thrashed and tried to reach back for him,
its clumsy, mismatched limbs badly failing at the task. Frustrated, the winged beast jumped and took to the air, Ted still on its back, as if the bat mantis intended to get him up high and shake him off. Up, the two of them went, up and up, a flash of lightning illuminating the pair for just a split second, revealing a glimpse of tiny flapping wings and a desperate thrashing struggle in midair. Then it was dark again. John lost sight of them in the starless sky. He stared, squinting against the raindrops that were dive-bombing his face. And then, a flash of light, like a new sun being born, bright enough to blind. The boom hit 2 seconds later. Down came a spectacular rain of brilliant, sizzling particles, filling the sky, landing in the floodwaters around them with a soft hiss. It only took John a moment to put together what had happened, that Ted had known the creature would try to take off with him attached, that flight was its only advantage. Ted was a soldier, a good one, and a hell of a lot smarter than the beast had been. He had just needed the bat mantis to get high enough, away from the innocence below. The last of the falling embers burned themselves out, and it was dark once more. No remains of either man or beast fell from the sky. For a moment, it was just silence and the rain. Then, the rain stopped. Amy. The rescue effort was an awkward disaster at first. The combined efforts of the three of them managed to get a whole 2 additional kids off the bus. The children were terrified of the rushing water and didn't want to jump off onto the jagged ledge of partially submerged pavement for fear of slipping off and getting swept away. Amy couldn't blame them. But soon, there was a rumble of motorcycle mufflers and a flock of headlights, the rest of the biker gang showing up late to the party. They formed a human chain from the street up to the wobbling bus, handing the children down to safety one at a time. Rather than get in the way, Amy, John, and David trudged back toward the RV. Amy had been so overwhelmed by events that it didn't occur to her until she stepped inside that she was bringing with her news that Loretta was now a widow and that Maggie was now fatherless. She made her way back to the lounge and sucked in a breath when she saw the blood. It covered mother and daughter, Marconi, the little sofa, and the floor. Loretta sat there, cradling Maggie's head in her lap, and Amy wasn't sure which one looked more exhausted. Loretta said, "What blew up?" Amy started to reply, but found she couldn't. John said, "Ted blew up the monster. It's gone. But he died in the process. I'm sorry. He sacrificed himself to save Maggie, and you, and all of us, maybe the world. If anybody ever tries to say otherwise, you can tell them to come find me, because I saw it myself." Loretta closed her eyes and leaned back against the window behind her. The corner was shattered where a pair of bullets had punched through at some point. She pressed her lips together and swallowed. Amy sensed the woman was cutting off the grief, like crimping a hose. Her daughter needed her, and there would be time to grieve for her husband later. Amy said, "How is Maggie?" From behind her, Marconi said, "From what I can ascertain, the 4 pellets perforated her small intestine. I have stopped the bleeding and given her something for the pain, but she needs a hospital." David said, "She does?" Amy glanced out at the huddle of kids standing on the pavement outside, being tended to by their parents. The bus driver was among them. Amy had written her off for dead, and she now imagined her at the bottom of the bus, down where it was filling with water, lifting up the children one at a time so they could breathe. A hero. With a tortured squeal of scraping metal, the empty school bus was wrenched free from the shore and went rolling down the river, colliding with the wreckage of the bridge. Several of the kids cheered. Marconi fixed his gaze on David and, in a lowered voice, said, "What I observe with my 5 senses is a child that has a very survivable wound, but that needs medical attention or else loss of blood or sepsis will finish the job." That is what I observe. From the driver's seat, Joy said, "Hang on." They were already moving before she finished the second syllable, taking them to the hospital. How did she even know where it was? David said, "Guys, we can't just leave. We have to watch them out there, contain them, figure out a way to, you know, take care of them the right way." Marconi said, "What do you propose?" David started to answer, but the words never came. Me. I sat there and stared out of the bullet-riddled rear window, watching the RV shit a stream of wet highway, the biker kids shrinking in the distance. The farther away we got, the less I cared. I was so tired and so cold and so wet. Above all else, I just wanted to be dry again. Then maybe to sit down with a beer and hug Amy while she watched some terrible Japanese cartoon about magical girls learning the power of friendship. No, I wouldn't do any of those things. I would see this through, this, and whatever came after. I turned my back on the window and watched the Maggie larva carefully. Then I blinked, and there was Maggie, the little girl. Bloody hair matted to her face, pale cheeks, a little gap in her front teeth. The sauce was wearing off. So small, so fragile, chest barely rising and falling as she clung to life. Maggie opened her eyes with what seemed like a monumental effort, looking right at me. With all of her strength, she raised one tiny hand, extended it toward me, and gave me the finger. Chapter 31. The undisclosed hospital was recently renovated and is now a pretty nice facility. After all that, we wound up spending the next few hours sitting quietly in a hospital waiting room, damp as dish rags, eating snacks and sodas out of their vending machine. Why were we there? To see if Maggie recovered? To try to contain her if she erupted into a towering shadow of doom? Fuck if I knew. John eventually fell asleep, sprawled across five chairs and snoring loudly. Amy leaned on me and rested her wet head on my shoulder. Joy, who was completely dry, casually filed her nails. Marconi mostly stayed out on the sidewalk to smoke his pipe and talk on his cell. He apparently had people he could reach out to for advice in situations like this. That must be nice. Eventually, Loretta came shuffling down the hall, and I noted she looked whole again, no longer appearing to have been attacked by a great white. It wasn't because she was whole, necessarily, but that the soy sauce was wearing off, and I was now starting to see what everyone else saw. I no doubt could have seen through the illusion with some concentration, but I had no concentration juice left in my brain. Besides, I knew the truth. Loretta said, "The doctor says she's going to be okay." John blinked sleep from his eyes and raised himself up on one elbow. "That's good. She appears, normal and everything?" "She's been through a lot." Amy said, "I'm so sorry about Ted." Loretta sighed and sat in one of the chairs across from us. "This is going to sound awful, but Ted, he never really came back home. From Iraq, I mean. We were high school sweethearts and, well, you don't want to hear our life story. It just seemed like he never forgave himself for what happened over there. It's like he felt he owed a life somehow, like it was an overdue bill he'd shirked. He kept moving us from place to place, paranoid about the government, about everything, sure that someone was going to come and make him pay what he owed. When Maggie got taken, it was strange because I swear it's like that's what he had been waiting for all that time. I don't want to say he wasn't upset, don't take it that way. But in those hours and days after, he was so alive. I hadn't seen him like that since right before he shipped out. He finally had another damned war to fight." Loretta wiped her eyes. Amy said, "I just hope that wherever he is, he's at peace." Loretta said, "If he is, well, I guess that would make one of us. The son of a bitch got just what he wanted, A big, heroic sacrifice. Now the rest of us are left to clean up the mess. He probably thought he was being selfless or something, but look what he left behind. What he did, that's the most selfish thing you can do. I want to find the jerk who convinced males that martyrdom is cool and kick him in the teeth. Loretta closed her eyes and pressed her lips together again, reestablishing control. Then she quietly excused herself and went back to see her child. Joy looked up from her nails and said, "I wonder if Waffle House is still open." I said, "Do you even eat?" "Don't be a dick." Amy sat up, my hand sliding off of her shoulder. She was watching Loretta as she plodded her way back to her monster baby. She said, "We were wrong, weren't we? We said the bug things dig up your worst fear to use against you, but it's not that. Ted got his war. John, well, he got his car chase, right? It's like..." She trailed off, watching Loretta disappear around a corner. From behind us, Marconi said, "I have found that our greatest fears and our greatest desires are, in fact, two sides of the same coin. I have known many who have died before their time, clutching that coin in their fist. Figuratively, of course." He had come up behind us at some point, now standing with his overcoat draped over a forearm. I said, "Jesus, you don't just sneak up behind people and start spouting wisdom at them. Not at this hour." I turned back to Amy. "So according to him, your proverbial coin is waffles, I guess?" I went to put my hand on her shoulder again, but she stood up, wandering away like she needed to stretch her legs. Marconi said, "I'm afraid I must excuse myself. I've an early morning production meeting. Then it's off to Minneapolis. Something is digging up graves, or so they tell me." He glanced at a pocket watch. "I'll assume any questions I have for you can be answered over email." I said, "Wait, what? This isn't over, Doctor. Do you know what's going to happen with the larva if we all just go back home?" "No. Do you?" "The best I can say is that a chick that cannot break free from an egg eventually dies. Or it doesn't get fertilized at all and someone scrambles it in a frying pan. All of this supposition is based on some very limited data." John said, "And the millibut will continue to spit out new ones." I said, "I'd have to consult my notes, but I'm pretty sure we didn't accomplish anything. We literally could have just stayed home and gotten the exact same outcome." Marconi said, "I admit this one will require some massaging at the editing stage." "So what's the story going to be?" "Very straightforward, I should think. It's the cautionary tale of a town in the throes of a panic over a supposed winged creature that witnesses claimed could turn itself into a man. A creature that managed to snatch 11 small children, all of whom were, thank goodness, recovered unharmed, thanks to the noble sacrifice of a brave veteran. But was all of this the work of an unearthly creature of the night? Or a mere human with a deviant mind? Which kind of predator is more terrifying? That, dear viewer, is up to you to decide. Now, enjoy this commercial for auto insurance." Amy said, 11 children? There were 12. You forgot Mikey. There is nothing to forget." She stared into the middle distance and said, "Oh, right." I stood up and stretched. "All right, we get a few hours of sleep, then we round up the biker kids and figure out what we need to do to contain this thing. Every minute counts, people." Chapter 32. 5 days later. We never saw the bikers or their kids again. They apparently took the rain with them. We got nothing but sun in the days that followed. The water levels still continued to rise, as Amy had said they would. Like all of life's bullshit, it keeps trickling downhill even after the storm is over. But otherwise, all we could do was keep rooting for clear skies. I wondered how many people had bought rain boots just hours before it stopped. Suckers. The neighborhood around the dildo store was all but impassable, but Amy and I had gotten our stuff and moved into Chastity Payton's sandbagged trailer. We had no idea where she was, but she was still alive, and Amy had saved her number before she left. Chastity agreed to let us squat there in exchange for keeping looters away, as long as we didn't take the plastic off the furniture or fart the place up. Still, she wouldn't have approved of how much Red Mountain Dew I'd stashed in the fridge. I didn't even enjoy the flavor of it. I think drinking it just reminded me of my early 20s, back when I enjoyed terrible things. It was Saturday, the day before Amy's birthday, when we got a mysterious call telling us to go out to Mind's Eye and to bring John. We had actually been out there a couple of times since the night all this shit happened, waiting for the whole cycle to start up again. It hadn't, but the call hadn't been entirely unexpected. We surely weren't the only ones monitoring the situation. We met John out there by the little church, which was surrounded by ladders and scaffolding. The owners were breaking local tradition by actually repairing the place instead of just letting it rot. They'd already gotten the roof patched up. A black sedan pulled up, and I was only mildly surprised when Agent Tasker stepped out, a bandage around her neck where her head had apparently been reattached. I wondered if it leaked when she drank coffee. John said, "Is your partner coming?" "No," he called in dead. "I'm not here to harm or arrest you, and in fact I do not represent none. That organization has been dissolved." I said, "You mean they just renamed it again?" "There is a, let's say, house cleaning taking place. We have ascertained that your judgment on the B3333B breach was in fact correct. We do apologize for any actions taken against you by the previous regime." "Meaning you," interrupted Amy, "when you tried to personally kill all of us over and over again. But I do want to point out that throughout the process, the information sharing between us was less than ideal on both ends. That's something we should look to improve going forward. In terms of B3333B, we are actively monitoring all 11 offspring and will continue to do so until an alternative course of action is found." I said, "Well, problem solved. I'll just put this whole thing out of my mind then." The sun was shining, and the pond below would have been shimmering turquoise. But there was no pond. The whole thing had been filled in with concrete. Crews had started filling it in the very next morning after the 10 larvae had emerged. There were workers milling around the area now, dragging thick hoses that snaked down from several trucks that were perched on the hill above. Tasker said, "As you can see, we've already gone to work on obstructing the breeding site." I said, "I don't want to tell you your business, but I 100% do not believe that a bunch of cement is going to keep the mill up, the B3333B from doing its thing." "Of course not. But we do have every reason to believe that physical proximity to the pond is a requirement for the process to work. The goal will be to simply keep people away." "You wondered what connection there was between Mr. Knoll, Ms. Payton, and the Christ's Rebellion Motorcycle Club. Well, they all attended a barbecue right here a month before the children turned up missing. That is, a month before the idea of the children were implanted in the adults, along with the trail of psychological breadcrumbs that would lead them back here." Amy said, "But people come here all the time. I guess that was just when its breeding cycle started." "When we were interviewing members of the gang, we noted one man named Beau Lynch, who bore a striking resemblance to Ted Knoll's description of Mr. Nymph. This aroused some curiosity in the team, though the man appeared normal and was not otherwise suspicious. During questioning, it became clear that at one point during the cookout, Mr. Lynch and a young woman had sex in the pond." This raised dozens of questions in my mind that I actually didn't want the answers to. Tasker continued, "By tomorrow, there will be a 12-foot fence around the hill up here. Those signs will be posted every 20 feet. She nodded to where one of the signs was leaned against the church. In urgent red and white, it said, "Raw sewage, contamination hazard. $1,500 fine for trespassing. 24 hours surveillance. I shook my head. It's not gonna work. People will figure out there's no sewage here. They're just going to get curious. Below us, one of the crew members shouted a signal. Then there was a sputtering noise and a gush of raw sewage sprayed out of the hose. The stench reached us a moment later. Amy wrinkled her nose and said, "That's... wow." "Okay," John said, "just to get this straight. In the meantime, these parents have to spend the next however many days or months or years raising these fake monster children? How is that not going to end horribly for everybody?" Tasker shrugged. "That is simply the way of the world. All they know is that they love their children very much. Love is not always a two-way street. Sometimes you pour your energy into something that never gives back. Like people who keep lizards as pets. Is that worse than being alone or without purpose?" I said, "Way worse." Tasker glanced at her watch and said, "Well, if you have any suggestions, you know where to find me." I watched her duck into her car and pull away. I imagined her turning her neck too quickly the next time she went to back up and her head just toppling off her shoulders. Amy said, "So, we need to resume the conversation we were having." "Which one? About whether or not a plane could take off if it was sitting on a giant treadmill?" "We decided it would take right off, the wheels having nothing to do with it. Nothing to discuss." "No. The one we were having at John's house. About your sadness, demon? And you said that wasn't the time to have the discussion? Well, that time has arrived. I've got a number for you to call. I know for a fact that they can get you in early next week. We can talk about it later." "No, we can't." She looked at John like this was his cue to jump in. They'd planned this. John, looking like he'd rather be chewed up in the belly of a shark than standing here having this conversation, said, "She has a bag at my house, clothes and stuff, a little money, friends ready to come and get her. She'd made the decision to go, is what I'm trying to say. I talked her out of it, told her that if you really knew what this was doing to her, you'd fight it." That black pool of shame bubbled up in my head again. Then a spark came along and set it alight. The choice between feeling the toxic ooze of self-loathing and the fire of mindless rage is no choice at all. I turned on her. "You know what? If you want to go, why don't you..." John stepped in front of me. "Can we just skip this part, Dave? The part where you have this knee-jerk anger reflex over being given an ultimatum? Because it's not an ultimatum, and nobody is trying to push you around. I've been here a million times, you know I have. And that anger, it's the rage of a kid getting dragged out of a warm bed on a cold morning. That's all it is. Because that depression, it's the most comfy bed in the world, and you will say whatever you have to say to stay in it for one more minute. But there's people out here who love you, a lot, telling you that there's a truck heading for that bed. And if you can't work up any concern for your own life, then think of it like this. Somebody Amy and I care about a whole lot is going to get hit by that truck, and only you can save them. The person we need you to save just happens to be you. Also, the truck is filled with shit. I don't know if I mentioned that. I just assumed." I sighed and carefully studied the patch of nothing in front of my face. "I am 99% sure this is just the way I am. Been like this as long as I can remember." Amy looked at me like I was an idiot. "Of course it's the way you are. But having really hairy legs is the way I am, and I still shave them regularly. In our natural state, we're all smelly, sticky, angry creatures nobody would even pay to look at in a zoo. We're all at war with that awful primitive version of ourselves every day. You're scared. I get it. You're scared you're going to get cured and suddenly be this corny, boring person. Well, I have good news. There is no cure. You just wake up another day and fight it, day after day, until that's who you become. A fighter. Look, it's up to you.
Only you can do this. But I'm not going to spend the rest of my life watching you slowly rot to pieces, stuck to the sofa like some kind of an airplane that is totally unable to take off from a treadmill due to the laws of physics. If nothing else, said John, remember that people depend on you. The next crisis is always right around the corner. We stood there and watched the ship flooding operation for a while. I gestured toward the crews below us and said, I don't like this. Amy said, well, it's gross on like 36 levels. No, I mean in general. We're basically being asked to turn a blind eye. Living our lives knowing this is here, like an itch you can't scratch. John flicked a cigarette butt and turned to go. He put his hand on my back as if to lead me away. Forget it, Dave. It's vagina puh. Chapter 33. A completely uneventful denouement. We can probably cut this part. Seriously, stop reading. Where the flood had receded, it had left behind a thin film of dried mud that turned lawns, sidewalks, and blacktop all the same grayish brown, like we had all been sucked into a sepia-toned photograph. But the town was still here. We were doing Amy's belated birthday at John's place 2 weeks after the actual date, having agreed to at least hold off on the celebration until we were no longer at risk of trench foot. The stealth house had made it out of the flood, needing only new carpet on the first floor, which had been badly overdue anyway, the old carpet having been assaulted by everything from coffee spills to fireworks burns. We showed up at the door at 8 that night to hear John screaming at someone from inside. The last phrase I heard before we knocked was, "That shit isn't cute anymore." He yanked the door open and let us in without a hello. He looked like shit, like he was 5 days into a bad flu. John had been fighting with Joy. She was off in a corner messing with her phone, as if she'd checked out of the argument long ago. To John, I muttered, "So she's still here." John snapped, "She won't fucking go! This is fucking ridiculous!" Joy looked up from her phone and said, "I dumped his stash. He's not happy." "You... what?" "The meth, the Adderall, the weed, all of it. Down the toilet it went. Whoosh. Bye-bye." John stabbed a finger at her. "You don't get to make that decision," I said. "You're arguing with a swarm of shape-shifting bug monsters, John." Joy said, "And losing." Amy said, "I'm going to get the casserole out of the car," and went back out. There was no casserole or anything else out there. I paused to contemplate the ridiculousness of inserting myself into this discussion, then said, "Seriously, Joy, you can't make somebody stop being addicted that way. You get rid of the drugs, the addiction is still there." She shrugged. "So, doesn't mean I have to make it easy." John looked at me. "See, this is fucking bullshit. I didn't ask her to live here. I didn't ask her to fucking watch my every move like she's a fucking parole officer. You know I sleep on the couch in my own house. You know you made her, right? I don't mean you made her stay here. I mean you made her, like that's the end of the sentence. That's what I keep saying. You see those clothes she's wearing? They're actual clothes. She bought them with my credit card. She can make herself appear to be wearing anything." Joy, still staring intently at her phone, muttered, "I like to shop." "My point," I said, in a lowered voice that Joy could probably still hear, "is that you can presumably make her just go away, right? I mean, either go away as in leave or go away as in poof, she's just gone. Hell, John, there's a real Joy Park out there in the world. How would she feel knowing you've created a clone of her and that you live with it?" Joy said, "It?" John said, "Yes, Dave, if the actual porn star Joy Park somehow shows up here from Korea, we will have to deal with that." Joy said, "Actual?" He said, "You know what I mean." Joy looked up from her phone. "Do you really want me to go?"
If you want me to go, I'll go. John took a deep anger-control breath, his hands balled into fists in front of him. He turned back to her and said, I'm not saying you have to go, but you don't control my life. This can't be how it is. Joy shrugged. We'll just have to agree to disagree on that. John started to explode again, but I put up a hand and said, You're ruining Amy's birthday. Come on. I went and stuck my head out the back door and found Amy standing on the stoop watching Nikki pull up in her Toyota Prius. John insists on inviting her to everything just because she's been a dear friend for the last 12 years. I said to Amy, It's over. You can come in. Nikki uncoiled herself from within the Prius, carrying a plastic box full of cupcakes. Her eyes were a pair of black portals into a soul that harbored only spite.
David!
Hello, Nikki. I have two red velvet cupcakes in here. Those are yours. If somebody tries to take them, smack them. Did you know red velvet is just chocolate with red food coloring added? No. Lying bitch. We went inside, and Joy's face lit up at the sight of Nikki. Hey, there's my girl. They hugged. I assumed that no one had explained that she wasn't human. I'd have to take Joy aside later and let her know. Amy pulled a birthday card envelope from her purse and said to John, Why did you mail this instead of just handing it to me? John looked confused. When did you get that? It was in the mailbox when we went to check on the apartment yesterday. I have no memory of sending that. I examined the card. Postmark is 3 weeks ago. John saw my expression and said, Hey, I wonder if it's a clue. Open it. Amy said, I'm almost afraid to. She opened it, and inside was a card that said, Happy Father's Day, Dad, in festive text that had been scribbled out with a ballpoint and replaced with Birthday, Amy Sullivan, in John's handwriting. There was something inside, a scratch-off lottery ticket. We all froze. I said, No. John, you bought that on the soy sauce? Amy looked alarmed. That's like a form of cheating, right? We couldn't. Could we? I said, Well, the whole thing is a scam. So what, somebody buys a ticket with a 1 in a billion chance of winning, not knowing that in reality they had a 0 in a billion chance? Seems like a pretty minuscule difference. It said across the top in silver letters that the grand prize was $10 million. Amy said, We're giving half of it to charity. I said, Fine. We don't even know if it's a winner. John said, I'm actually pretty sure it is. Amy fished a nickel from her pocket and scratched off 3 rows of boxes. We had won. $250. John said, Hey! You can buy Amy that book now. Almost. You can probably talk them down. Amy said, What book? I had never told her about the signed copy of Hitchhikers I'd shopped for. We had decided that my decision to follow through on treatment was my gift to her. Still seemed like she was getting cheated, but whatever. I said to John, You could have won us the freaking Mega Millions jackpot, and you got us $250 instead? Amy said, $125. Out of nowhere, John started laughing. I didn't know what exactly he thought he was laughing at. I still didn't have a damn job. But then I was laughing too. Then so was Amy. Joy and Nikki asked us what was so funny. Amy said we won the lottery and that this was the best birthday ever. Joy high-fived her and said she had 2 different homemade pizzas in the oven, and I guess we were letting this thing make food for us now. Then Munch and Crystal showed up, and it was like the whole previous month had never happened. Then there was a knock on the door, and John went to answer it, and standing there was the fancy-haired partner of Detective Herm Bowman. He asked the 3 of us to come outside. I had assumed Herm would be waiting out here, but the young man had come alone. I closed the door behind me and said, If you're here to tell me more kids are missing, I'll say it right now. I don't think we're up for it. That's not it. And I don't see Detective Bowman. Nah, he says case is closed. Won't even talk about it. but you're not ready to drop it, right? You see what your reality show friend said about all this? The whole bit about a flying monster snatching kids? Yeah, so you were there. What did he get wrong? One, I wasn't there, not really. And what he got wrong are all the parts that make you look guilty as shit. Ah, I see. Herm's putting ideas in your head. Well, believe what you want. We all live in the reality we choose. What kind of hippie bullshit is that? Look, the case is closed, like I said, so why not just tell me what really happened? From the start, for my own peace of mind. It won't leave this stoop, and even if it did, who'd believe me? The other cops will believe you, they just won't care. It's better that way. Ask Herm. So, like I said, what do you have to lose? I glanced back at John. What do you think? John shrugged and said, Fine. You want to hear a story? Well, buckle the fuck up. So we told him the story just as it's laid out in these pages. I finished with, And then we all gathered here to celebrate Amy's birthday, and then you showed up, and here we are. John said, We may not have made it clear, but Marconi had two spears on the RV. I said, Right, he had lots of them. They were all over the place. The detective nodded thoughtfully. I was eating a donut, not a McMuffin. Yeah, but it seemed too cliché. You know what? I like Marconi's story better. Me too, if I'm honest. Mainly because it actually lines up with the known facts in the case, where your impossibly convoluted version seems carefully crafted to be utterly impossible to verify at every goddamn step. What I know is there were 12 missing kids reported. No follow-up from any of the parents, all of whom are in the wind now, including Loretta Knoll. Sightings all over the place of this supposed bat monster, which, I said, is now scattered in tiny chunks across miles of river. Problem solved. And two victim statements identifying you as the perp. We've been over that. And one witness saying the bat monster is you. This brought the conversation to a screeching halt for several brutal seconds. I thought I heard thunder rumble in the distance, but I think it was just a heavy truck passing by. Amy said, What? Who? Philip Shitbeard Hickenlooper. Ted's friend? The one who drowned? Who said he drowned? He not only made it out, but says he watched your man here turn into the Bat Mantis on one occasion, and suspects it in another. That brought an even longer silence. Someone coughed. I said, Well, that's just ridiculous. Everything was chaos. Who knows what he thinks he saw? That's probably why he has that nickname. He's so full of shit, he, you know, wears it like a beard. Uh-huh. Did I mention he has you on video? Recorded it at the river, with his phone. When it was dark and rainy, plus any asshole can download video editing software, they can add special effects and everything, make it look so real it'd fool an expert. Doesn't prove shit. The detective just eyed me, silently. I said, What? Instead of dismissing the idea that such a video could exist, you jumped right to calling it a well-made fake. Didn't even ask to see it first. Amy said, There is no video, is there? Don't need one now, do we? I said, Oh, fuck off. Don't play your cop mind games on me. Even if this ridiculous accusation was somehow true, and I'm not saying it is, but even if it was, then that still wouldn't implicate me. If anything, the Bat Mantis was trying to help. If it turned up where kids were being taken, it's because it was trying to stop it and failing. If this ridiculous fantasy of yours were true and we took steps to hide its involvement, it would only be because we knew people would get the wrong idea, focus blame in the wrong place when it was clearly this other situation with the mine and all that. But we didn't, because your story is ridiculous, yes. Remember when I said I liked Marconi's version better? It's because I'm pretty sure you people made everything up. The larva and the mine monster. One big convoluted parable about not judging monsters. Just to cover for the fact that boy here started werewolfing out and snatching children. I laughed. Ha! Ha ha! Ha! No. John said, how about this? In our version, the Bat Mantis is dead and gone. Nobody else gets hurt. In Shitbeard's version, it's still around, you know, because